So good morning to everybody, and many thanks to be here at a quite early time. You all deserve definitely a medal for being here this morning at 8:30, and we welcome all of you. So we will now, during this this session, this best practice forum on the cybercrime convention, really have an informal meeting with some presentations, and we will try really to do it as practical and informative for you as possible, and of course leave as much time also as possible for questions and a debate among all of us during this session. So in the outline agenda that you received, you can see that basically there will be a presentation that I will start with on a general presentation on the Cybercrime Convention to put it in a global framework. And then you will have a presentation from Marco Gerke, who will tackle the need for an international legal approach in the fight against cybercrime, and also present you briefly, among other best practices that we will tackle this morning, the example of Romania. And for your information, very quickly, Marco is teaching criminal law with a focus on cybercrime at the Faculty of Law in Cologne, in Germany, and he's a visiting lecturer for international criminal law at the University of Macau. And he has been, during the last years, a very frequent national and international speaker and recognized author in the field of cybercrime. Then after, we will have two presentations, one from Christos Velasco from Mexico, and another one from Pavan Dugal. And they will be basically sharing with us some best practices from their respective countries, Mexico and India, and explain also how the Cybercrime Convention basically can be used and was used and is being used in their countries to improve the legislation and to favor international cooperation. So for your information, Christos is a Mexican attorney specialized in the field of international trade and technology law. He's a professor and co-founder of the graduate course on legal aspects of ICTs at the Instituto Tecnológico Autónomo de México, and he's also the founder and general director of the North American Consumer Project on Electronic Commerce, NACPEC, which is a nonprofit organization facilitating information on the regulation of the internet and e-commerce consumer protection at the international level. And Pavan is an advocate at the Supreme Court of India, and Pavan is the president of Cyber Law Asia, with whom Council Europe will also tomorrow morning organize the workshop on legislative responses to current and future cyber threats. And Cyber Law Asia actually is an Asia's pioneering organization committed to the passing of dynamic cyber law in the Asian continent. And Pavan has been associated with the Ministry of Communication and Information Technology at the Government of India on cyber law and electronic governance legal issues. So now that the presentations are made, I suggest very quickly to start with making a general presentation on the Council of Europe Convention. Maybe we could turn the lights so that you can see a bit better. Yeah, that's okay? Don't, no, it's not? It's not? Maybe we can reduce it, I don't know. Okay, diminish a bit, thanks. Okay, so basically the Council of Europe Convention on Cybercrime as a framework for national action and international cooperation against cybercrime. Maybe the first thing to do, especially since we're not in Europe here, is to explain you a bit what the Council of Europe is about. And basically, it's the oldest organization in Europe, intergovernmental organization, which was founded in 1949, and which has currently 47 member states. So you have all the countries of Europe, apart Belarus, who are part of the Council of Europe. And basically, the job of the Council of Europe is very simple and straightforward. It's to promote democracy, the rule of law, and human rights on the European continent. And basically, in our fight and basically on the strategy that we have developed since a number of years now against economic crime, basically the idea why we are getting involved in that is basically to take measures against organized and economic crime on the European continent and let's say beyond, in order to promote the democracy, rule of law, and human rights. So basically, the approach here is the following. As it was explained yesterday, the Council of Europe is mainly a standard-setting organization. So in all the fields there and in many others, corruption, organized crime, money laundering, trafficking human beings, and of course, cybercrime, we have, let's say, prepared a number of standards, instruments, including the Convention on Cybercrime and its additional protocol, as you can see there, on xenophobia and racism acts committed through computer systems. And so this is one part of our work. Now, once the standards are set and the member states or countries have signed and ratified the convention, another important thing that we are doing is basically to monitor the compliance to these conventions and to evaluate to which extent the members or the countries, the states that have signed and ratified our convention, comply with the provisions of those conventions. And for the Cybercrime Convention, doing that monitoring, the implementation of the convention by the member states, you have the Cybercrime Convention Committee, the TCY. And for your information, the next meeting of the TCY will take place in April 2008. And then, as a third pillar of our approach to tackle, in particular, this field of cybercrime, we develop a lot of technical cooperation projects, very practical projects. And among others, you have, which is mentioned here, the project on cybercrime, which is funded by the Council of Europe with a great support for Microsoft. And the main objective of that project is to promote the Cybercrime Convention and its additional protocol worldwide and to favor its implementation in all over the world. And basically, we're doing that by helping states in the world to strengthen their cybercrime legislation. So we help them, if there's a request on their side, to draft laws which, let's say, comply with the provisions of the Cybercrime Convention. We have also a second part of that project, which is to basically strengthen also the capacities of the criminal justice systems, basically to investigate, prosecute and adjudicate cybercrime. And by doing that, we organize a number of trainings upon request at regional level in country, trainings on cyber offenses, on content-related offenses, on public-private partnerships, on development and creation of specialized bodies, etc. And then finally, just for your information, the third part of that project is an important one, which is to reinforce the capacities of the criminal justice systems to cooperate internationally. So, very briefly, I think since time is running and we don't want to leave a lot of time for the questions and the debate, it's clear that there's a lot of reasons. Today, it was expressed many times yesterday, to take action against cybercrime. But here, only to mention what is important for the Council of Europe, referring to what I told you in the beginning, it's really to keep a balance, a fundamental balance between the protection of rights and freedoms of the citizens, of the internet users, and also the legitimate concerns of law enforcement authorities for security. Okay, so the Convention on Cybercrime and its additional protocol on racism and xenophobia committed through computer systems. This convention was elaborated, as I told you, by the Council of Europe with the participation not only of European states, but of states such as Canada, Japan, South Africa, and the United States of America. And it was opened for signature in November 2001 and entered into force in July 2004. Now, this has really to be seen very closely and as a whole, as a part, with the protocol on xenophobia and racism committed through computer systems, which was opened for signature in January 2003 and entered into force in March 2006. The structure and content of the convention, just for your information, it's a bit dry, but it's, I think it has to be mentioned. Of course, the first chapter tackles a number of definitions. What is a computer system? What is a computer data? What is a service provider? What is traffic data? So all definitions which have to be agreed among the states and make sure that there's a common understanding about a number of important elements in the field of cybercrime. Then the structure is the following. You have the second part, chapter 2, which is dedicated to the measures to be taken at the national level. And then the third part, basically tackles international cooperation. So measures at national level, of course, you have some substantive criminal law. What are the type of behaviors that need to be made criminal offenses in the states? Procedural law provisions, measures to be taken for to allow for more effective investigations of cybercrimes, and then what refers to jurisdiction. Now, on the international cooperation part, you have some general principles of cooperation, and then specific provisions for more effective cooperation. Just here, after the definitions, coming to the measures to be taken at national level, you have a number of offenses, basically against the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of computer data and systems, including illegal access, illegal interception, data interference, system interference, misuse of devices. And so all these offenses need to be criminalized in the national legislation. in the substantive criminal law. You have also the Title II related to computer-related offenses, including forgery and fraud, content-related offenses, such as child pornography, and infringements of copyrights and related rights. Just want to for your information, draw your attention on the fact that Article 9 of the Convention relates to child pornography, and basically it explains there a number of conducts which have to be also made criminalized, basically, in the national legislation. Now, procedural law part, you have there some common provisions, the scope of procedural provisions, conditions and safeguards, number of provisions on the expedited preservation of stored computer data and traffic data and partial disclosure, production order, search and seizure of stored computer data, and real-time collection of computer data. When it comes to the third part related to Chapter 3, international cooperation, basically you have the general principles of international cooperation, as well as the principles related to extradition, mutual legal assistance, spontaneous exchange of information, and confidentiality and limitation on use. There's an important, when it comes to the specific provisions, an important article to be mentioned, which is the Article 35, which basically foresees the creation among the states that have adopted and the convention, the creation of a 24/7 network, which basically invites each party to designate a point of contact available on 24-hour and 7-day-a-week basis to ensure the provision of immediate assistance for the purpose of investigations or proceedings concerning criminal offenses related to computer systems and data, and also the collection of evidence in electronic form of a criminal offense. So basically, this is a bit similar to the G8 network of contact points, and really is a very efficient tool allowing for basically international cooperation, and especially allowing states to react very rapidly once, let's say, an offense has been committed, which requests the assistance of neighboring countries to gather data or exchange information. This is not... Okay, when it comes to the protocol on racism and xenophobia committed through computer systems, briefly mentioning here the dissemination, which has to be criminalized, dissemination of racist and xenophobic material through computer systems, racist and xenophobic motivated threat, as well as a racist and xenophobic motivated insult, and also the denial, gross minimization, and approval or justification of genocides or crimes against humanity. As I briefly mentioned to you earlier, Article 46 relates to the consultation of the parties, the Cybercrime Convention Committee, which has the objective to monitor the implementation of the treaty and basically to facilitate an effective implementation of the treaty and identify also potential problems. The TCY also is a good forum for exchange of information, and also is invited, and that will certainly be the case, because this is, of course, a live it's a instrument which has to adapt to the very quick evolution of the situation when it comes to information and communication technologies. So the TCY will certainly be invited in the coming months to propose possible amendments or supplements to the treaty in order to reflect this this evolution. So for your information, next TCY on 3 and 4 April. And now really, before giving the floor to my colleagues, what we consider as being the benefits of the convention, it's indeed it gives the possibility to states to have a coherent national approach to legislation on cybercrime. It facilitates the gathering of electronic evidence. It facilitates the investigation of cyber laundering, cyber terrorism, and other serious crime. It allows, of course, an harmonization and compatibility of criminal law provisions on cybercrime between different countries. And it is a good legal and institutional basis for international law enforcement and judicial cooperation between the different states which are part to the convention. So, as a conclusion, as you can see, and as I told you, it in the Convention on Cybercrime entered into force in July 2004. To date, you have 22 ratifications. We know, of course, that a number of countries in Europe and elsewhere will ratify the convention also in the coming months. It's a long process, of course. And as of 9 November, you have 43 states which have already signed this convention. Legislative amendments and ratification process are underway in many other countries. And what is important also is to stress, and that's commonly admitted, that the convention is becoming a global instrument. Again, signed by Canada, Japan, South Africa, ratified already by the United States of America. We have, and that's that was not the case before, a lot of non-European states that have signed and joined the convention. A number of others will be invited, like Costa Rica and Mexico, to accede very soon. And so, really, this is really a global instrument which Council of Europe is trying its best with the support of many other international organizations and partners to promote at the world level. Just information on Protocol on Xenophobia, 11 ratification, 23 signatures. And that's it for nine. Just wanted to stress again that it serves really globally, the convention, as a guideline for national action, national legislation in the field of cybercrime, and it's a good framework for international cooperation. And that really Council of Europe is not working solely on this issue. It's cooperating in a common effort with many other international organizations. We have a very close partnership with ITU. We have also developed and organized a number of activities, joint activities, with ITU, with ASEAN, with APEC, with OECD. Many other countries, private sector, Microsoft, others will join soon, and other stakeholders. And really, we are ready to continue to do this effort with our international partners and to assist if there's any request on your side from one of your countries to strengthen your legislation. So that was it. I hope I was not too long, but I thought it was important to put the Cybercrime Convention in perspective. So now I will ask Marco to come and address on the need indeed for a legislation response and to share with us some good practice, including the one of Romania.
Thank you very much, Jean-Charles, and thank you very much for the invitation. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Yesterday we realized there are many questions related to the Convention on Cybercrime, so we would like to leave some space for your questions at the end. Therefore, I'm going to rush through the presentation. I would like to give you some information why or how the Convention on Cybercrime help you in your countries to address the challenges of cybercrime. The first issue I would like to speak about, it can help you identify gaps in your national criminal law. That means in the existing criminal law provisions that you have in place regarding cybercrime, there might be some gaps, some offenses that you are not able to cover. That's a classic phenomenon, because when you see, it's just an example, on the left side you see a new technology being introduced. Shortly after that, you see on the timeline there is an offense. In this case, short after networks were introduced, we realized the first hacking attacks. And a long time after that, and that's typical, the states are introducing new substantive criminal law provisions. So this, in this time gap, there are criminal law provisions missing. And this is something that we cannot accept. If we want to effectively fight against cybercrime, we have to react very quickly and to delete those gaps in our national criminal law. And that's something where the Convention on Cybercrime can help you. If you analyze your national law and you mark a point there where you have a legislation in place, for example, computer fraud, yes, we have a legislation in place, then you can compare this like a DNA profile of your cybercrime legislation with the Convention on Cybercrime. And you will then be able to identify those gaps that you have, where you say, well, there is a provision in the Convention on Cybercrime, which is the international standard, and there is no provision in our national law. And this is something where the Council of Europe can even help you. This is something we are doing on a regular basis, and I'm very happy that I am able to introduce to you Professor Gilberto Martins de Almeida, who's here present today. He's one of those leading experts in the world that are dealing with this topic, coming from Brazil, teaching here at the university, and who is just undertaking approaches with the Council of Europe to analyze the law in Argentina to identify possible gaps for them. And that's not the only example. The Council of Europe did a number of researches in the past. We have Jahid Jamal here from Pakistan. We did something with them as well. So this is something where the Council of Europe, on your request, can help you and assist you to identify the gaps in the national law. Just one example for a possible gap in your national law, phishing. Those emails that you're receiving asking you to go to a website and enter personal information there that can later on be abused is not criminalized in many countries. They're not able to effectively fight against people sending out those emails and trying to take over the identity or personal related information of another person. The Convention on Cybercrime does address it. The Convention on Cybercrime has a provision in place that does already criminalize sending out those kind of emails. It's a computer related forgery mentioned in Article 7. So, this should just explain to you how the convention can help you as a state to improve your national legislation with regard to substantive criminal law. But that's not the only thing. If you want to effectively fight against cybercrime, you do not only need the right provisions. You need investigation instruments. And it is, as Jean-Jean pointed out previously, one of the main interests of the Council of Europe to have instruments in place that are effective on the one hand side, but that keep a balance with regard to human rights and the rights of the users on the other side. So again, the Convention on Cybercrime is giving you a number of instruments which are different from other legislative approaches that we see at the moment. For example, unlike the European Union, which is not the same as the Council of Europe Convention on Cybercrime does not include a provision establishing a data retention obligation. That means service providers are not forced to store any information about what you're doing on the internet. No, those instruments are focusing on the suspect only. So it can be very interesting to have a look at those instruments because they are not as much affecting the rights of the users. And let me point out, that's one of the advantages of the negotiations in the Council of Europe, unlike, for example, in the European Union. Because in the Council of Europe, it was not only those states from Europe that came together to negotiate, there were many other states involved. For example, the United States was involved, and South Africa was involved, Japan was involved. So, you know, the Council of Europe, the convention is actually a summary of a lot of different approaches, and they all agree to one level, and that is ensuring rights of the users as well. So that's a very efficient instrument to ensure it. And I would just like to explain to you how difficult it is to investigate cybercrime. I'm not going to go in detail, but just if you realize there is a server with illegal content in a country, somewhere in the Asian region, you need a number of instruments to investigate in this area. There are different legal instruments necessary. There are some instruments, search and seizure procedures, for example, but it can be tracing back the IP address. You might need access to certain data from a provider. So I'm not going to go into detail, but I would just like to tell you it's a very complex investigation. And the Convention on Cybercrime is helping you to update your national law and implement those instruments that you need to effectively fight against cybercrime. That can be search and seizure procedures, that can be access to stored computer data. So those instruments are included. I'm just going to point out one instrument, just as an example, quick freeze procedure. The idea is data are often deleted very quickly after a user did something, committed a crime, and the idea is that you can contact a service provider immediately by phone and say, don't delete this information. Keep them, we will see a judge to get an order, come back, and then we seize these information, but don't delete them. So preserve them so we can continue an investigation. I'm quite sure that in most countries, from the people present here, such provision is not implemented, but we need it in cybercrime investigations. It can happen that very important information are deleted very shortly after the end of the use, can be minutes, can be hours, so we need possibilities for quick reaction on the national level. Okay, that was the second step, second possibility to improve. The third one is international cooperation. And I'm again trying to explain that with an example. Let's say we have a victim in the United States. He is realizing the computer system is attacked. And you're able to trace back the route to a computer in South America, in Brazil. So you realize the American authorities realize the attack was coming from Brazil. So if they now need 6 months to go through mutual legal assistance, ask for a request of local authorities, it can happen that when the search and seizure procedure is undertaken and they have a look at the computer that was attacking, it turns out it was not the computer user, the owner of the computer that was starting the attack. It might have been someone who was acting somewhere else in the world and app using this computer system to hide his identity. So the real offender might be based somewhere completely different. If these investigations take long time, the traces to the real offender might disappear. So what we need is possibilities of immediate reaction on an international level, as well as I explained previously on the national level. So on both levels, we need to be very quick. And that's something, the third pillar of the Convention on Cybercrime, it is establishing means of international cooperation. And as a criminal law professor, I can tell you that's something completely different to those instruments we had in place previously. It is giving you the possibility to phone somebody and say, help, I need the request, I need your help, please carry out an investigation in your country. Because as you know, the principle of national sovereignty does not allow you to carry out investigations in another territory. So you need the cooperation of the other countries, and the Convention on Cybercrime is giving you easy means to do that. I will explain to you the principle of the 24/7 network just briefly. That is how it looks like in the moment. If Russian authorities want to communicate with authorities in the United States, if there is somebody who detects a cybercrime, he's trying to find somebody in the United States to help him. So there's a lot of communication going. It's very difficult, frustrating, because you don't find the right people. And this is something that the 24/7 network wants to help, because what can happen is you call them and there is no one in the office, or you don't find the right people. So the idea of the 24/7 network are 2 points. First of all, there will be one contact point in each country. And this contact point will be the one that is collecting national requests. So if a law enforcement agency in Sao Paulo has a problem with the United States, they will contact their local 24/7 network point. And the local 24/7 network point, which is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, will then contact his designated counterpart in the United States, which is one institution, which is again available. And the advantage is they all know each other. And if there is a personal relation, it is much easier to cooperate. The Council of Europe brings them together on a regular basis. So they learn to know each other, And then this 24/7 network point will be able to identify the right institution and place for the request. So it's on the one hand side 24/7 available. That's the first advantage. And the second advantage is it's much more systematic approach than anybody just calling somebody. So it's a different approach and is completely improving the idea of international cooperation. Just a quick look at the number of ratifications we have at the moment. You see it, I mean, the number is okay, but now you can see where they are based, many of them in Europe. We have an invitation going to Mexico and Costa Rica. They're invited to sign the convention soon. There are negotiations going on with a number of other countries, especially in the Asian region. So it is a progress that is still taking place, and I think the next time we're going to meet, the map will already look completely different. But in those countries, you already have the contact points. That means if you want to cooperate in those countries, those instruments are existing. But it is necessary that you implement them as well and that you sign and ratify the convention, because that is giving you access to the system. And then you will have those information about each country that has already signed and ratified the convention. Where is the contact point? How can I contact them? And it's very efficient. I've seen those people talking from different countries, completely different people coming together and very efficiently fighting against cybercrime. Okay, three steps. Fourth step, I'm still trying to persuade you. Harmonization. I mean, we're only talking about national law at the moment. How can it help you in your country? But there is an essential element. Without harmonization of laws, we are unable to effectively fight against cybercrime. And the reason for that is the principle of dual criminality. If you're trying to investigate a crime that is not criminalized in another country where the offender is coming for, they will not cooperate. They will maybe not even be able or allowed to cooperate, even if they want. So we've seen that with the I Love You virus in the Philippines. I've just been there 3 weeks ago for the Council of Europe, and they were still mentioning this case. Somebody from the Philippines designed the virus. It infected a computer system around the world. They were not able to prosecute them because it was not a criminal offense in the Philippines. So what we need is, or first of all, how it looks like in the moment, we have countries with completely different legislation in place. Some countries do criminalize certain offenses, others don't. So what is happening at the moment is there are some countries that can cooperate because they have the principle of dual criminality. If they didn't ratify the convention, they don't have the right instruments in place. It might take longer, it's not as efficient, but in general they could cooperate. Other countries simply can't cooperate because they don't have the same provisions in place. So the idea of the Convention on Cybercrime is to have some set of minimum standards with regard to the substantive criminal law provisions as well as with regard to the procedure instruments. So you can be sure that all other countries that signed and ratified the convention have the same provisions in place so you can effectively fight against it because you have the same criminalization. There is no problem of dual criminality anymore because you have the same provisions in place. So that is the basic idea of the convention. And it does not mean that you cannot go beyond that or that the convention will cover all possible cybercrimes. No, it is defining a set of minimum standards. And when you have a look at the convention, you will see a number of things are not mentioned there. For example, religious offenses related to cybercrime. This is something where the countries could not agree on something. There is no standard, no worldwide standard. Some countries criminalizes, others don't. So that will always be a place for regional or national approaches. But the minimum set is the one that we need on an international level. All right, fifth step. And this is from my point of view, maybe the most important one. What you can do, and this is important, and I'm just an external expert for the Council of Europe, but I would like to invite you to participate in the ongoing negotiation about further approaches we need to undertake to fight against cybercrime. It is, as I explained before in the negotiation, it was not a European negotiation. It was an international negotiation. But as soon as you signed the convention, you can participate in the ongoing discussion in the cybercrime committee. So you can say, well, we are realizing there's something going wrong and we need different legal instruments. Or we in our region are facing different problems. As a developing country, we have different problems. So please, let us address this. That's something where I think is the greatest advantage. And I would like to explain that to you by giving you two examples. First, new offenses. Second Life, a virtual world, very popular. But for 2 years now, we are facing there are a number of crimes going on there that we sometimes cannot address. What kind of provision in your national criminal law applies if somebody steals a virtual object in one of those virtual worlds? If he steals a car, which does not exist, it's a piece of data. So what happens? How can we apply our national law there? Well, you maybe say, I don't want to apply it, but he can sell it on eBay. He can sell the virtual objects on eBay and make a lot of money with that. So you have a profit in the real world by committing a crime in some kind of virtual world. So this is a new challenge for our national criminal law, and this is something that will be addressed, that will need to be addressed on an international level. And this is something where it will be very difficult for you to do it on the national level. You have to bring all your experts together, and even then, it's not comparable to the Convention on Cybercrime Committee, where you have even more experts, and where you might have the chance to come quicker to a solution. And I give you a second, give you two more examples. The challenges of fighting cybercrime. There are hundreds and thousands of challenges. Let me point out there are possibilities as well. That's an example where that was presented in the media as a breakthrough in the fight against child pornography. I mentioned yesterday that I don't believe that. The picture on the left is the picture of a pedophile showing his face, and he used a filter technology to hide his identity. And it was descrambled by law enforcement agencies. That's the second picture. And finally, that's the suspect of the crime. So this is, of course, a possibility where we see information technology improve the work of law enforcement agencies. But it is just one case. And I would like to give you two examples why there are challenges which are not addressed yet and that we need to address in the future. And again, the Cybercrime Committee is the right place to address those challenges. First one, availability of information. I grew up in a town not far away from a military airbase, and it was not marked on any map that you could buy. If you bought a map of that area, it was not marked. It is military infrastructure, it's secret military infrastructure. But if you go to one of those providers of satellite pictures, you can see it, and you can not only see the airfield, you can see the plane standing there. So if you plan an attack, the internet has very valuable resources, and offenders are making use of that. And it's not only that. If you want to commit cybercrime, there are guides how to commit cybercrime. So we have a problem. We have a problem that we're facing the fact that there are information available how to commit crime. And the question is, how do we address them? Do we need a special offense for that? Or is this just preparatory act? So this is a discussion that we need to lead in the future. And I will give you a second discussion, a second point. And this is just one out of many. Encryption technology. So law enforcement agencies, and I'm going to do this as a practical example, and that's about the end of my presentation. Law enforcement agencies are more and more often facing the fact that offenders are using encryption technology. And I would just like to show you how easy it is. If you want to communicate with somebody else and just send them a message, encrypt it so nobody can read it, it is not a big act. There are plugins that you can send out messages that are encrypted that are available for free. You don't have to even to press a button. But I'm going to do something. I'm going to type a text here. Hello, my friend. You see I'm typing it on the bottom, and there is the encrypted message. So I can copy it, put it into my email, and it is very difficult for the law enforcement agencies to handle with this, because I'm going to show you something now. I'm going to show you how long it takes to decrypt the information. So I have a slide for you, a calculation. So what it is actually doing is I'm going to put in, this is the size, or this is the strength of the key that the offender is using. He's using a 20-bit key, let's just say that. So there are 1 million possibilities how the key could look like. 1 million possibilities what he could have chosen as a key. So if you have a computer system that can go through 1 million operations a second, can try 1 million different keys, it will only take you 1 second and you have the key. You broke the encryption, you have access to the information. Law enforcement agencies will be very sufficient. You know, it would only take them 1 second, and then they would know what the suspects were communicating about. But let's just see how this number develops when I'm changing the strength of the key. So I say I'm using a 40-bit encryption. So now you can already see that it takes you 12 days to break the encryption if you're using the same machine. Okay, third step, we're going to go for a 56-bit encryption. So now you can see that you need 2,000 years to break the encryption. It is impossible. I mean, who can do it? But let's be very optimistic, and let's say the governments realize that the law enforcement agencies need more computer system. They do not only need one computer system to break encryption, they need 1 million computer systems to break encryption. And let's say they don't get normal computers, they get supercomputers. So now you will see, okay, you're down again to 20 hours to break the encryption. Positive. That's possible. But now comes the bad news. The offenders, like regular people as well who are using encryption technology, are not using 56-bit encryption. The weakest one you find in the market at the moment is 128-bit. And it takes you longer with 1 million computer systems to break the key than our universe will exist. So I was meeting a colleague from the Netherlands, and we spoke about encryption. I mean, it's not only used by criminals, it's used by government authorities as well, law enforcement agencies. So it's not only used by criminals, but if they're using it, you're running into problems. So we need solutions for that. And this is, again, something. This is a topic that we need to address on an international level. Otherwise, it will simply not work. There are possibilities. One solution would, for example, be allow law enforcement agencies to use key loggers so they can log the key the offender is typing in his computer. So that would be a solution. You wouldn't be able to break it, but if you get information about the key, that would be a solution. So that was basically my presentation about the challenges. I am just going to, before I hand over to my colleagues that are going to explain you some more, give you some more information about how the Convention on Cybercrime helped them to prove their legislation, I just wanted to say there are actually two possibilities to implement the convention. It is leaving you a lot of space. If you go through the provisions, you will see it is very often tell you, well, you can make reservations, you cannot apply this, or you can require additional elements. So it's not something that you have to take one by one in your national law. It gives you the possibility to react to national traditions, to legal traditions in your national law, and implement the provision in a way that is still comparable to other countries, where you still can take the advantages. So it's a process of adoption, of implementation, which is very important, and discussion as well, discussion. So Romania is one of the examples, a country that we're regularly taking as an example, because they implemented the convention very close to the wording of the convention, which is the idea. You should choose the same language, but make use of the reservation if you want to change the purpose of the offenses, maybe require additional mental elements. So I would like to hand the floor, first of all, to the chairman, and then to my colleagues to speak a little bit more about how it helped them. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Marco, for this excellent and very convincing presentation. I'm a bit afraid to see that the timing is running very fast. So I'm giving the floor immediately to Christos. Don't worry, we'll leave time for questions and we'll wait until we are kicked out of the room. And until then, we're definitely at your disposal. So Christos, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I want to thank the Council of Europe for the invitation to participate in this forum. I was in Strasbourg in June this year, and I provided a general summary on the legal framework concerning cybercrime and law enforcement in Mexico. This presentation is available in the Council of Europe, the Octopus website. Well, just to start my presentation with, I'm going to give you a general background of where Mexico stands. Mexico is not official; it's not officially part of the Council of Europe, but it has an observatory status within this organization since December 1st, 1999. It's important to point out that Mexico has not officially accepted or approved the Cybercrime Convention and its protocol on xenophobia and racism. However, during this Octopus conference, and due to the relevance of the topic in Latin America, the Mexican government announced, along with Costa Rica, its intention to negotiate access to the convention and its protocol. Okay, one point I would like to focus. How would Mexico benefit from the adoption of this convention? Well, there are many aspects. We firmly believe that Mexico would benefit first because it would lead to a general reform of the adjective and substantive criminal legislation and filling the existing loopholes found in the current legislation. In addition, it would lead to the development of a uniform and more cooperative enforcement approach among the federal and local enforcement authorities, the National CERT, and other anti-crime prevention groups. Okay, well, since the spirit of this forum is to provide a best practice example, well, I'm just gonna focus on the enforcement of criminal legislation against child pornography on the internet in order to illustrate this audience about one particular aspect that the National Cybercrime Police has been very proactive in combating at the national level. It's worth noting that Article 9 of the Cybercrime Conventions provide for the adoption of legislative measures to establish criminal offenses and domestic law to punish four types of child pornography activities through computer systems. These activities are, first, producing it for purposes of distribution; two, offering or making it available; three, distributing or transmitting it; four, procuring it for oneself or another person; and five, possessing it in a computer system or a computer data storage medium. I will then move to briefly discuss the provisions found in the federal criminal legislation against child pornography. So the federal criminal legislation contains four different provisions. First of all, there's Article 200 that provides imprisonment terms for from 6 months to 5 years and monetary fines from the equivalent to $1,800 to $3,000 to individual who commercializes, distributes, exposes, offers, or makes available photographs, images, books, recordings, and films of pornographic nature to persons younger than 18 years old. And even the legislation go further to explain persons who do not have the capacity to understand the meaning of the crime. So the Mexican legislation is very, very specific on that regard, because there's been problems with regards to the interpretation of the law when it comes to enforcement of these crimes. Also, Article 202 punishes the crime of child pornography specifically, and this includes also with the persons that procure, oblige, facilitate, or induce by any means to other persons to perform sexual acts or of corporal exhibitionists with lascivious or sexual purposes, whether real or simulated, or with the purpose to record, photograph, film, exhibit, or describe them through printed advertisements, transmission of data archives in a public or private telecommunications network, computer systems, electronic, or substitutes. The imprisonment terms for these crimes range from 7 to 12 years, and fines from the equivalent to 4,800 US to 12,000. Also, the criminal legislation contains another article which criminalizes the stock and leasing of pornography material, which is contained in Article 202 bis. And this article provides an imprisonment from 1 to 5 years and a fine from 600 to 300 US to the person who stocks, acquires, and leases the material referred to in the previous Article 202 without commercialization or distribution purpose. Such article provides for a specialized psychiatric treatment to the person involved in child pornography. Also, the Mexican legislation goes a little bit further and goes beyond even the Cybercrime Convention and punishes the crime of sexual tourism. This is a crime that is contained in Article 203 and 203 bis, and punishes sexual tourism activities with minors and its promotion in national territory with imprisonment terms from 7 to 12 years and monetary fines from 4,800 to 12,000 US dollars. Also, Article 203 bis expressly punishes the conduct of sexual activity with minors as a result of sexual tourism with imprisonment from 12 to 16 years and monetary fines from 12,000 to 8,000 US. In Mexico, there's a cybercrime police unit, which operates under the umbrella of the Ministry of Public Security since the year 2000. The cybercrime police unit has been very, quite active in combating child pornography, corruption of minors, and the prosecution of pedophile organized gangs at the national and international level. This has been the priority of the cybercrime law unit, although it's now trying to move into more sophisticated attacks such as phishing and spam and financial attacks. But this is the priority of the cybercrime law unit so far. Well, another good practice example that Mexico has done. In June, well, as a matter of fact, after the Strasbourg conference, the Octopus conference, Mexico announced the confirmation of a multi-stakeholder group called the e-crime Mexico group. The e-crime Mexico group, as I said before, is a multidisciplinary effort with the principal mission of preventing and reducing cybercrime in Mexico. The members of this group, well, it's the Internet Society, the chapter, the Mexican chapter, the NIC Mexico, which is the CCTLD domain administration, the National University, the Banking Association, industry, and other chambers. The tasks include identifying, monitoring, prosecuting internet-related crimes, including fraud, phishing, and all those crimes involving information systems. Analyzing and informing about the latest threats to security systems on the internet and fostering a culture of information security in Mexico. It's really important to point out that before the confirmation of this group, there was another group which was called the DC Mexico. This was a task force that also worked under the umbrella of the Ministry of Public Security. But since there's a lot of changes in the Mexican government, I mean, the work of this group was somehow stopped and detained. So therefore, this was, the internet industry and the academic sector decided to confirm this group in order to give continuity to the prosecution of internet crime, right? And well, that's pretty much it. I will stop there so that I can lead, so that Pavan Dugal can talk about it and perhaps leave 5 or 7 minutes for multi-stakeholder participation, which is the spirit of this forum. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Christos. And now I give immediately the floor to Pavan, please.
Hi, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here amongst this distinguished audience, and thanks to Council of Europe for inviting me. When you come to India, you're coming to that part of the Asia where the context is different, societies are different, the growth of the internet is on a different plane altogether, and yet you have the Asian tigers waking up. India and China, in the coming times, will become one of the biggest markets of e-commerce in the world. If that happens, the question is, does the Cybercrime Convention act as a best practices forum for countries in Asia? My submission is that this is a great opportunity for national governments to examine their national laws in the context of Council of Europe. Well, India was slightly ahead in history than the Council of Europe. We enacted our cyber law in the year 2000. It came into effect on 17th of October 2000, at the time when the convention had not yet come into force. And though this was a law that was meant for promoting e-commerce in the country, yet there were some provisions on cybercrime that were put in. So it's not a cybercrime law, but we did have various provisions in the said law pertaining to cybercrimes. Well, the law really at that point of time, which is still the law at the time when I'm talking with you in these 7 years, has specified cybercrimes as special crimes which can only be investigated by police officers not below the rank of deputy superintendents of police. Some of the major cybercrimes have been covered under the Indian cyber law. Just to give you some specific examples, we have tampering with computer source documents. We have hacking, and we have publishing of obscene electronic information. These are the three fundamental cyber crimes that get covered under the Indian cyber law. Well, the law says if you are knowingly or intentionally concealing, destroying, or altering, or intentionally or knowingly causing another person to conceal, destroy, or alter any kind of a computer source documents or computer source, well, it's a penal offense made punishable with 3 years imprisonment and 200,000 Indian rupees as fine. Well, the imprisonment is 3 years. We've had various cases that are currently going on in India under this provision, but no case has yet reached its final fruition stage. We have the widest possible definition of the term computer hacking anywhere in the world. Section 66 equally goes to say when somebody with an intention to cause or knowing that he is likely to cause wrongful loss or damage to any person or the public destroys, alters, or deletes any information residing in a computer resource or diminishes its value or utility or affects it injuriously commits hacking. Again, hacking is made punishable with 3 years imprisonment, 200,000 rupees fine. No yet conviction on hacking in India at this time. This is slightly different in its approach. India is a land where we've had eroticism as a part of our culture. So the distinction of what to classify as obscene has always been a challenge for legislative approaches in our country. Consequently, the legislature has been extremely studious in not using the word obscene, but says anybody who publishes, transmits, or causes to be published electronic information which is lascivious or which appeals to the prurient interests, or if its effect is such as to tend to deprave and corrupt the minds of those who are likely to see, read, or hear the same, that's what been made an offense. And various cases are currently going on. Well, this is a very serious cyber crime. First time you get convicted, it's 5 years imprisonment and 100,000 rupees fine. Second conviction, the quantum goes double. 10 years and 200,000 rupees fine. Well, we also have provisions concerning a breach of privacy and confidentiality, misrepresentation, and publishing digital signature certificates which are false in certain particulars or for fraudulent purposes. Well, if that's not sufficient, the Indian law has provided a step ahead, and that step is in the form of providing civil liability for slightly cyber criminal activities. So if you are entering into somebody's computer system or computer network, and are merely securing access, downloading, copying, or extracting data, introducing a computer contaminant, or disrupting the working of a computer system, or assisting any person in such of these illegal activities, you are actually being provided another remedy, that's of providing civil liability of damages by way of compensation of 10 million Indian rupees. And that's one of the very proactive steps that we are currently seeing. All, mind you, all these provisions are much prior to 2001. These provisions came into effect since the year 2000. Now, since those periods of time, the Council of Europe's Convention on Cybercrime has come into force. India has been studiously examining the same. In fact, I personally believe that the convention provides a great opportunity, a reservoir, or a repository of collective wisdom of the world. And for any nation, especially the developing countries, who are right now trying to match up their cybercrime legislations or even their penal code legislations, we realize that the Convention on Cybercrime is an important resource on which you can actually go back and check up. Another good thing about this cybercrime convention is that it is providing the minimum standards. And as the context of societies and networks differ from the West to the East, you realize that here is an opportunity for you to take up, in principle, some of the important cybercrimes or procedures that's given therein, and go ahead and try to incorporate it in your respective national legislations. Mind you, each country has got its own national sovereign requirements, and those requirements have to be appropriately fulfilled, keeping in mind the national interests. But be that as it may, these best practices that are given in the Convention on Cybercrime becomes an important starting point. Well, Indian government has not been far behind. the Indian government has been looking at amending the Indian IT law. The government of India had actually come up with the proposed amendments in the form of Information Technology Amendment Bill 2006. To some extent, a number of principles that actually find mention in the Convention on Cybercrime have been appropriately found their representation in the proposed amendments. These amendments actually have gone to the Parliamentary Standing Committee on Information Technology, and this Parliamentary Standing Committee in its recommendations has also highlighted certain important principles which need to be incorporated in the proposed cybercrime amendment legislation of India. So here is an opportunity. A country like India, who doesn't really come into the physical, geographical parameters of Council of Europe, but a country which has got its own specific requirements, does find that here is a collective repository of wisdom, where you can actually go back to this, you can have those minimum standards, and since international cooperation is a huge issue, I think the parameters and the infrastructure that's provided under the Council of Europe could be an important starting point. Be that as it may, I still believe that the national sovereign interests of each country have to be determined, keeping in mind their respective requirements and their respective goals. And while the Council of Europe can be a starting point, each national government can go ahead and develop appropriate national approaches to cybercrime legislation in the world. I believe my one bottom line is there's no need to reinvent the wheel. Well, if every country wants to say, look, I would go ahead and come up with a model legislation, with a fantastic legislation, you are by all means likely to proceed ahead. But here is a question of the wheel having already been invented. And if it's been invented, a better option and approach will be, let's take the advantages of the invented wheel and then go ahead forward. And I think if you can appropriately use the best practices given under the Council of Europe in your local legislation, keep in mind your appropriate local customizations, and then make your appropriate national laws, here becomes a good, very, very starting point in this regard. In fact, in this entire room, we have Dr. Gulshan Rai, who's the Director of Computer Emergency Response Team of India, and he has also been very much behind the proposed legislations and the proposed amendments, and the government is pretty much alive to this huge repository of wisdom. Of course, we are yet to see more amendments being crystallized and being passed by the Parliament, but purely in the context of cybercrime, where the Convention on Cybercrime is the only successful international model of an international treaty available, a good starting point for countries in Asia would be to look at this particular convention, make up appropriate changes, adopt new technologies, but go ahead and try to utilize the infrastructure, the bases, the principles, and the foundations provided to make up your own edifices of national legislations. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Pavan. Now it's 9:45. Basically, we have 15 minutes and maybe a bit more for question and answer. So we open the floor directly. Please, if you can raise your hand, and then we have a mic here. Actually, bon, I can go. And you present yourself, and then we will try to answer. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, thanks. Any questions, Ula?
Thank you. I'm Tapani Tatvainen from Finland, representing Electronic Frontier Finland. And I'm kind of worried about the apparent lack of concern for potential government abuse of the convention, and in particular the fast mechanism described by Mr. Gerke. For example, consider that some government wants to track down a blogger criticizing the government, or maybe for some religious offense that's not criminal in other countries. How do you prevent that kind of request being made for other purposes than covered by the convention? If you get a request from one government or police saying that we want to track down this criminal, how do you make sure that the crime is real crime and not political dissident, for example?
Well, again, by the principle of dual criminality, as soon as you're leaving the area of crimes that are harmonized,
Each country will again apply those principles, which are the fundamental principles of international criminal law, and I guess apply in your country as well, that you will only cooperate if the crime is an offense in your country. So if you say, if for example, an example is pornography, there is quite liberal laws with regard to pornography available for adults in Europe. It's a completely different situation in some of the Asian countries where there's a complete ban on pornography. So that would be a crime where international cooperation would not be possible because of the fact that the laws are differing. So we will always have that. We only have core crimes where all countries can agree on and where international cooperation will work, where the means will apply. But in other cases, the international cooperation will lack on the fact that there is no harmonization.
Just a little clarification. How do you verify that if you are in a hurry? They get, we have a criminal doing this. You have procedures to actually check that the crime is what is it.
Again,
short time makes it difficult.
I try to quickly answer. The request will come in on the 24/7 network point, and the 24/7 network point will be a place where maybe, let's say, 5 or 10 or 3 people will be in place. They know what are the offenses and are they criminalized or not, because that's another advantage. You will have the right people in place who know the legislation, will immediately be able to say, no, sorry, that's something where we cannot work together.
They can be lied to.
It can always happen, that's for sure.
Hi, I come from Argentina, and I have a little question related to an example that Mark gave to quick freeze. I'm wondering what happened, for example, in Argentina, and I suppose in other countries also, we need a judicial order to access or intercept some personal data, etc. And how this procedure, quick freeze, match with the law procedures in different countries in which we require another judicial order?
That's an excellent question. I will try to explain it very briefly. In general, most of the countries at the moment require an order by a judge if you want to carry out certain investigations. This takes a lot of time, in many cases too long. So the idea of the convention is the following. With Article 16, you can order someone to preserve data. That means he's not allowed to delete them anymore. He needs to prevent them from being automatically deleted or manually deleted. But you don't get access to the data. They will remain where they are. So law enforcement agencies, and that's the idea of the order of the judge, should not get access to the data unless they have an order by a judge. So Article 16 is only preserving the data. Now you want to have them. Now you need Article 18 of the convention, which is enabling you to access those data, and there you can require an order by a judge. But with the preservation, you ensure that they are not deleted while you're applying for the order.
Thank you very much. My name is Benedek, University of Graz in Austria. I have a question regarding Article 15 of the Convention, when it says that adequate protection of human rights and liberties is left to domestic law. And first of all, in an international convention, you're a bit surprised that this issue is left to domestic law only. But what I'm most interested in is how is this happening in practice? I mean, do we have any good practice also in this respect of balancing, for example, privacy, freedom of expression, interests with the investigations taking place against the crime? And a question in this context also, how are you dealing with different national systems when it comes to content? Here we have very large differences between United States, Europe, other countries, and so on. So again, from a practical side, how is this being dealt with? Thank you.
Again, thanks for the two good points. First one is Article 15 in general, and when I went through some criticism related to the Convention on Cybercrime, Article 15 was very often mentioned. Privacy groups said, you know, there are so many crimes mentioned there, so many instruments mentioned, but only one provision dealing with protection with safeguards. The difficulty was, while negotiating the Convention on Cybercrime, the countries realized, the participating parties realized, that they can easily agree on substantive criminal law provision, they can easily agree on procedure instruments, but the safeguards are completely different regulated in the countries worldwide. So we have a completely different system of safeguards. So the idea to have explicit safeguards was impossible, because the countries would not have been able to implement them. So the idea was, we have one fundamental principles of safeguards laid down in Article 15, which contains general principles, and these are minimum standards that even other countries outside Europe, where the European instruments mentioned there would not apply, would nevertheless have to implement. So the idea is to have it regulated in one place, and the countries, while implementing it, have to refer to it. Have to refer to international standards, as well as applying the same national standards they have implemented for instruments outside the internet to instruments regarding the internet as well. So it's of course, when you read it, it sounds like very theoretical, but in those ratifications that we've seen, we went through those safeguards that were implemented and compared them to the existing legislation in the national law, in the CPC, as well as to international instruments, and it turns out to be a rather easy thing. I wouldn't say it was easy within the implementation, but it was successfully done in those countries where I was reviewing the legislation that was put in place. And there was a second question related to content. If you go through the convention, you will see that content-related offenses are very much limited to child pornography. That's the only content-related offense you have in the convention. There are other content-related offenses related to racism, which are in an additional protocol. The reason for that is exactly what you pointed out. There is a completely different understanding of freedom of speech and the limitation of freedom of speech, for example, in the United States and in Europe. And so the representatives of the United States in the negotiations mentioned, if we include content-related offenses, apart from child pornography, where we can agree on, in the convention, we will not be able to sign it. So therefore, the decision was made, because other European countries raised the same issue, to leave it content-related to a separate additional protocol, which will not be signed by all countries, and have only those core content-related offenses, child pornography, in the convention, and avoid difficulties.
Better. My name is Stephen Ryan. I'm the general counsel of ARIN, which is the number registry in the North American region. I just want to briefly say that we cooperate constantly with law enforcement on authenticating records that are necessary for court for all of the sovereign governments within our service area. So for the United States, for Canada, for the islands of the Caribbean. So there is a cooperation between the non-governmental organizations that are in the internet sphere and the governmental one, and we require authentication in the sense of either a subpoena or a command, typical of the country's sovereign law enforcement practice to command us, but we do it very quickly in the same speed that is necessary for these investigations. The second point I'd like to make, and then I have a question, is that the way to avoid much of the content issue with regard to pornography, child pornography cases, is to, for the governments to aim at the monetary portion of those cases. There is a credit card facilitation and a monetary piece that if you decapitate that, you take away the business, and then you don't have to prosecute the individuals who you know, are sad people who get the pornography, but are only the individuals doing that. And so if you concentrate on the business end, we find that that is a very good strategy. My question, and I apologize, as a US lawyer, I'm embarrassed. Tell me how my government adopted the convention, because I was unaware of that. Thank you.
So I may take part one and two, and maybe Jean-Charles will go on for three. First of all, thank you very much for mentioning your international cooperation experiences, because we will need them in the future as well, until all countries have this instrument in place. But the advantage of the 24/7 network will be that I mean, the United States, you have a long tradition of cooperation, and you're investigating cybercrime for a long time. The first computer emergency response team was founded in the United States. So there are other countries that don't have this infrastructure and don't have this tradition. So there you can then rely on the 24/7 network point. So it will nevertheless be important to have this in those countries which don't have a similar infrastructure in place as you do. And the second point is, well, concentrate on credit card bills and money, the way money flows. That's a U.S. approach. Take the Illegal Gambling Act in the United States, which is criminalizing the participation of financial institutions in illegal gambling on the internet. Good point, but it's a different approach other countries take. It is not something that you find that you can harmonize worldwide. So what you need, first of all, you have to agree on the offense, and then you can use the money flow as an additional element to trace back, investigate. So that's the two points. Jean-Charles, do you want to?
Very, very quickly. Basically, you did like all the other countries. United States is an observer, also has an observer status, but that has nothing to do to the Council of Europe. And American experts, U.S. experts, like other experts from all the member states of the Council of Europe, were closely associated and involved in the preparation, the redaction of the convention. And then after, we basically received a request from the United States to accede to the convention, which it was allowed to by the other parties, because the member states of the Council of Europe have to allow, let's say, outside members of the organization to accede. They authorized that through the Committee of Ministers. Then it was signed and ratified by the normal procedure there in the United States. That's it. Yeah.
Just two amendments. Betty Shea from the DOJ was present all the time in the negotiation. And if you go to cybercrime.gov, the US, it's a US website run by the DOJ, you find many information about the convention as well as the ratification process. So there is most of the legislation was already in place, so it was for you just a very little step to do it. And we will just see in the future if everything is already in place or maybe some amendments have to be made.
Good morning. My name is Daniel Molenaar, and I work for the Dutch Telecommunications Authority, one of the law enforcement agencies in the Netherlands. And I have one question which is bothering me, well, for many years now, and especially again this morning, which is that we focus so much on policy and on treaties and lawmaking. But what I want to know is how much is really being done on law enforcement? Because, well, thank you. That was not what I was looking for. I was looking for answers more than that. But the thing is that we focus so much on the rules and the regulations, but there are so many countries that at least that I don't know of that actually do anything in law enforcement. Because, well, in child pornography, of course, many countries do act, and counterterrorism also. But let's say the hardcore cyber crimes, like the spreading of malware and spam, are practically undealt with in most countries. So how do we stimulate law enforcement and not just the adoption of good rules?
I'm going to make a general comment. Well, law enforcement agencies can only act if the act is criminalized. So the legal part is very important. You know, they very often don't act because it's not criminalized. So they only have to say, sorry, not a crime in our country. As you said, malware is not criminalized in many countries, distribution of that. So that's the first point. And the second point, of course, you have to train them. And a cybercrime strategy cannot only contain legal instruments. You need to ensure the education of the society. You have to tell them you can avoid many crimes if you educate them. And you have to train law enforcement agencies. So that's absolutely crucial. They need the right instruments. I mean, technical infrastructure. We need regular training. 5 years ago, there were no hard disk in cell phones. USB devices look different. So if they want to investigate successfully, we need to do that. But the Council of Europe is stressing out always that is we can only deliver one part. And they actually take over other parts as well. In Serbia, they have a 2 years, 1.5 million euro project where Jean-Charles is involved, where we just had two workshops each 1 week where we had experts from the UK going in the country and explaining in detail how computer forensic software works, how investigations are carried out, what you do when you come to the crime scene. So of course we need to do that. That's something that's essential, but this should in general be done on the national level, Nevertheless, the Council of Europe has realized how important it is, and going beyond its basic ideas and trying to promote that. But we definitely need to do that, no question.
Yes, well, in the case of the Latin American countries, in particular in Mexico, it's a capacity building issue. I mean, most of, for instance, in the cybercrime law unit has like limitations with regards to people and money to invest to capacity building. Some of those people don't really have the skills, so they need to go and train in other countries and speak the language, of course, and get familiar with all the legal and policy instruments that are happening at the international level. So in Mexico, it's a pretty much a capacity building issue. And this is, I mean, this example that I provided on the new e-crime group, it's a good example of a bottom-up approach. So we're starting. We're starting with a multi-stakeholder group, and now we're trying to learn from each other. I mean, there's a lot of technicians, legal people, engineers, so also the cybercrime law unit. And this is important, no? So we should start from the very bottom and then like go from there to up, no? But yeah, it's capacity building. Yes,
in the Asian context, I can't agree more with you. Law is one issue. Implementation is another. But implementation, by the very language of the convention, is left to national jurisdictions. And it's here that capacity building plays an extremely important role. India, for example, is part of the 24/7 network. We go ahead in giving all kind of reciprocal information. But more importantly, I believe the beginning point in that regard is for the governments to set aside requisite budgets for capacity building, which invariably is not a priority for a large number of governments. Because when it talks about training, updating various skills and tools for detection, investigation, and prosecution of cybercrimes, all that is going to take a lot of resources of money, time, and energy. And governments need to realize that the quicker they do it at the national level, the better off their respective jurisdictions will be. Thanks.
Hello, my name is Gadi Evron, with Aphilias, and my question is actually, I understand and really appreciate what you have been doing here, thank you very much, on the policy side, but carrying on from my colleague here, you have spoken about 24/7 centers, you have spoken about global cooperation, you've even given the example of Romania, and I'm really interested in finding out a little bit more about how far have you gone with implementation? Because to be honest, unrelated to your efforts, which are, again, very much appreciated, we are somewhat, and I would use a somewhat harsh word here, castrated. If there is any issue we want to deal with, whether it's between friendly countries, unfriendly countries, God forbid, related to cybercrime or other crime today, we have to go through mostly Interpol. And nothing against Interpol, this usually would take, after a lot of policy writing, editing, re-editing, rewriting, consulting, moving between different government organizations, then making sure everybody agrees on the language again. Once it passes to Interpol, I don't need to tell it to many other people here, it will take a long time, let's arbitrarily say 6 months. By the time this is all done, say it reaches Romania, and you know, I'll skip to that point, sorry for taking so long. You spoke about the United States as being signed on this, and I can tell you from personal experience, Romania today, again, nothing against Romania per se, is, with a lot of other countries, a central hub for a lot of the cybercrime, fraud-related cybercrime happening. For that matter, Brazil, which is very responsive, is also plagued by this. Can you please tell us what has been actually implemented so we can use it, because today, we have practically no way of pursuing cybercrime globally, implementation-wise. Thank you.
What country are you coming from? Okay. There is, no, I'm just asking because of the question if you have a 24/7 network point that you can ask, but what you can do is... Oh, okay, no problem. I will just take Romania. Romania has one in place. It's a prosecutor. We can hand out, we can give you the number, we can give you the contact data, so that is no problem. It's Ioana Albani. That's her name. That's no, you need the microphone again.
To use the United States as an example, I can tell you for the IRS has been dealing, the Revenue Service has been dealing with a lot of phishing attacks these past 2 years with a lot of losses. that are not exactly publicized, and they've been trying to contact Romania for a very long time. I'm sorry I'm picking on Romania, this is an international problem. I can pick on Israel. They've been trying to contact Israel seriously now, not the IRS, that's actually the FBI, for a while, and it works well, but it takes a long time. Now, since the IRS has failed with Romania, for example, I know the FBI is now attempting to send a delegation over to Romania to create some information on this, but again, I'm really interested to know how effective these centers have been globally, and if law enforcement in each of these respective countries, all these different agencies actually know they exist, and that they can go to them, and what's the procedure in doing that?
I have to refer to what I've tried. I maybe didn't make it clear previously. The idea of the 24/7 network point is that it is contacted by another 24/7 network point. The idea is not, like the G8, that anybody contacts a 24/7 network point. So 24/7 network points do only work with regard to investigations where in both countries involved, 24/7 network points are active. But nevertheless, what we can do is we can provide you with the information, who is responsible there. It is not the normal way that you should contact them because you don't have a 24/7 network point, but nevertheless, they're in place and I'm quite sure they will help you. So it's just for them, it's difficult. The idea is that they should shield from other requests so that this chaos is not coming in again and that they should only answer to requests from other 24/7 networks. But the same with the G8. It's the same network. They have a huge network, but not anybody can contact them. He needs to have his own contact point. So that's the difficulty, but they are very efficient. I can tell you. I met the 24/7 network points had a meeting. Chris Painter from the United States is leading the G8 network, the G8 group of contact points, and they had a meeting at the same time where the last meeting in Strasbourg took place, and it was amazing to see how successful they were working. So they are there. They're real people. They exist, and they're busy every day. They don't go to the beaches.
And okay, now just to add, count because you're absolutely right. It's good to promote a tool, but it has to be efficient. Okay, indeed, I can only confirm what Marco said, and we make sure that all the states nominate a contact point, and we have this information available. Of course, we don't want to disseminate it all over the world. Now, if you have any particular request, we can discuss about it, and then we can provide you some information. But they exist. There's a sort of diary that in which all the contact points are listed with all their contact details, and it's not shared. It's shared among themselves, and it's used and it's effective. So that's the only thing I wanted to add. Okay, you and then the gentleman after who has been waiting for a long time. And then for me, no problem. We're here anyhow. But as long as nobody bothers us, we can continue if my colleagues are okay. Yeah. Yes. Okay, good, very good.
Thanks. Please. My name is Eric Iriarte. I am from Peru. I have different hats, but in this moment I put, I am the chief of ILAC 25. ILAC 25 is the Regional Strategy of Information Society, and the 25 goal is the goal about regulation in all Latin America. This is a group conformed by governments, civil society, and private sector. And the final report said directly that the governments of Latin America will signate the European Treaty, the Cybercrime Convention. Why? Because we believe that this convention could help us to harmonize our regulation about cybercrime. Maybe this is a news for a lot of people that a governmental body working in this issue for the region, but the principal problem is not about regulation itself. With the signet of the convention could be easy. The principal problem is law enforcement. The principal problem is capacity building. And the principal problem is how we will make these ethereal ideas and put directly in the national legislation. Could be a good news because around 40, 35 countries now will very close to start the process to be included inside the cybercrime convention.
Thank you. The gentleman over there, yeah. And then, yeah, you deserve it.
on, let me ask the...
In the meantime, okay.
I'm Gulshan Rai from the Ministry of Communication and IT, India. I have two supplementary questions. There were some talks were said about the images. Google mentioned, word was mentioned in the presentation, and the availability of high-resolution images on the network. And the second was is the encryption. What about the steganography tools which are being used? So my these two supplementary questions are there. What's the stand of the European Convention on the availability of high-resolution images as well as the steganography tools? And one suggestions I have is that when you talk about 24/7 centers in the law, we must put some limit that the information exchange or sharing will be within certain specified period maximum. Otherwise, the way we are finding with the Interpol or the MLATs, it will take longer time, and the cyber crimes, they require need to be handled in a very short possible time. Two supplementaries and one suggestion.
Well, I'm going to pick up the second one, steganography. Very efficient tool to hide information. It's close related to encryption. In encryption, you would encrypt a message, send it out, and people can see there is something encrypted. People are communicating, don't want to see anybody what they're speaking about. Steganography is the technology used to hide information in another document. For example, you can hide a text file in a picture. It's very easy to do that. The Convention on Cybercrime does not specifically address this problem. There is a provision in Article 6 about illegal devices, which is giving you the possibility to prosecute acts related to the production, dissemination of tools, software tools that can be used to commit certain crime, but it is not a crime to communicate. So therefore, this would not be covered. It's a preparatory act. You can, for example, use steganography to hide information from a censorship. It can be very valuable information. I was in Luxembourg, one of the financial districts, and there was a financial company that says they're using steganography to hide secret information for ages. So there is no criminalization of the use of steganography in the Convention on Cybercrime yet. Absolutely, I said yet. So that means that's a point that we need to discuss. Of course, it can be abused by criminals, and then we need to ensure if it is possible. But like with regard to encryption technology, there are technical solutions where you're simply not able to identify what there is in. You're not able to prosecute it, even if you would have the legal means, because it's not possible on a technical level. But that's something that needs to be discussed.
Thank you very much for the presentation, and good morning, everyone. My name is Gisil Santa Rosa. I'm from Brazil. I'm the chairman of the Brazilian Association of Intellectual Property from the Information Technology Committee. And we have been studying the Cybercrime Convention for quite some time here in Brazil, particularly because Brazil has a POS 78, which is a bill of law that has been on the Senate right now. And apparently, as I thought like 2 hours ago, I thought was deeply inspired in the Cybercrime Convention, but as I've seen from your presentation, there might be a few differences. My first question is, whether there has been any exchange of information between the Council of Europe and Brazilian authorities regarding this this upcoming bill in the Senate, because as I've seen from your presentation, and even from presentation from Mexico and India, our law here might have a few extra points which have not been dealt with here, and we might think that. Our thought at the Brazilian Association of Industrial Property is more like to keep it closer than the Cybercrime Convention than what has been seen in Brazil. And my second question is, I'm sorry, I forgot your name. You're in the, Michael, yes. As Michael mentioned, there is a demand for certain service providers to store information. I just want to, since Brazil states that this demand for storing information, this bill of law states that the information should be stored for at least 3 years, and it doesn't really mention how this information should be stored and how it should be treated. And I just wonder whether there are any rules
in the Council of Europe regarding how this information is treated, how long the service provider has to keep it. And those are my questions. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, I'm going to take the second part, and Jean-Charles will comment on the official one. There is no data retention directive, data retention obligation in the convention, therefore there is no legal procedure which is laid down. You will find something like this in the European Data Retention Directive. There you find exactly which kind of information should be stored, how requests should be made. But there is currently a work group that I'm co-chairing in the Council of Europe that is dealing with developing recommendations for the cooperation of law enforcement agencies and internet service providers, and that will be a topic there. So if you give me your contact information, we will keep you updated about the outcome of that study.
Hi, my name is Silvia, and I'm from Brazil. I'd like to make a question about the use of key loggers, as you mentioned, and how to conciliate that with privacy and freedom of expression.
Absolutely great point. I can again refer to the United States that was developing a tool. The FBI has developed a tool, I think it was back in 2001, called Magic Lantern. It's a tool that it was actually used to infect the computer of the suspect and lock the key. So if you compare the impact on the suspect, you know, somebody is coming into your room or even installing it remotely, it's installing the keylogger and is then recording what you're typing. If you compare the impact of this measure, which is a very weak measure, compared to the approach in the United States, in Great Britain, that is forcing anybody who's using encryption technology to hand out the encryption, and if you don't follow the advice, you can be convicted by just that fact that you're not handing out the information. I would see the technological approach by using keyloggers is a better one, but it needs, of course, to be limited to suspects of crime, and then we have to define the crimes. So it's, of course, not an option to include a keylogger in any computer, distribute it, and simply use it for any purpose. It must be criminal investigations.
Zahid, last question.
Yeah, just very quick point. I've heard a lot about the fact that the Council of Europe is doing a good job, etc., but enforcement is important. Having dealt with cybercrime cases in Pakistan, for instance, we find that if the legislative drafting is not compatible with other countries, and it's not well drafted even, when you go to court, the entire money spent by enforcement agencies to get the case to court finds that they get acquitted. Subsequently, you can also not cooperate. Supposing they say, well, this is cyber squatting or some sort of cyber crime, and the local legislation does not say so. When you go to court to get an extradition, that's not going to work either. So the first step is you must have harmonious legislation.
Agreed. Sorry. Yeah, that's the perfect ending. Again, just I can stress that. Like we said it before, apart from let's say all this legal support that Council Europe is offering, we also, through our technical project, are organizing a lot of practical workshops, trainings involving several countries, sometimes national trainings, with law enforcement, with prosecutors, with judges, really to make sure that the information is disseminated and that best practices, with the support of European bodies and experts, are really shared among, practitioners, especially from law enforcement in Europe and elsewhere. It's really time to conclude now. I want to warmly thank all the members of the panel for their excellent presentations, for their support. Thank you for your very dynamic approach and proactive attitude. And if you're interested, tomorrow morning at 10:30, there will be another council workshop organized on legislative responses to current and future cyber threats with a much larger panel, other panelists, so you're invited there. And then in the meantime, of course, we're at your disposal if you need any further information. And I advise you also to consult the www.coe/economiccrime, in one word, website, where you have a lot of information and presentations on the subjects that we tackled this morning. So thank you very much and hope to see you later.